This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 6th of February, 2010, and joining me today for our monthly conversation is the inimitable Bob Chapman, formerly the world's largest silver and gold stockbroker. These days, he runs the International Forecaster newsletter at theinternationalforecaster.com. Bob Chapman, it is always a pleasure, and thank you for joining me again today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you all for listening.
Well, Mr. Chapman, recently on the Corbett Report, we were discussing the history and the background of George Soros, who is an extremely influential financier and someone who has extended and parlayed his financial power into political power through things like the Open Society Institute and his control of various media outlets. And as one of the financial oligarchs who is currently promoting his vision of the New World Order any chance he gets to anyone with a microphone, it didn't take a lot of scratching at that surface to start uncovering some very disturbing things about his background. So one of the clips that I played in that episode was a clip of yourself last year on the Alex Jones Show talking about George Soros as a young boy in Nazi-occupied Hungary. Why don't you tell the listeners who may not have caught that episode of the podcast about the incident?
Well, it's interesting. We mentioned it again on Friday with Alex, but George Soros, when he was 14, 15, 16, in that age area, the Germans came into his country, and Mr. Soros was Jewish. And he was able to pass himself off as not being Jewish, but being able to help the SA, which is part of the Gestapo, go around and round up Jewish people. And the Germans were as much interested in getting the assets of these people as they were in shipping them out to some camp someplace. And so George would work with the Gestapo, and he would take and roll his own people out and then find out from where their riches were hidden in the house or in the yard or wherever they were keeping them. And they would steal it, and it would be turned over to the German government, and I'm sure George and others lined their pockets as they completed that process. And of course, the poor souls, most of whom were Jewish in this case, were sent off to work in labor camps, and those who were unfit were eliminated. And so this is how George got his start in life. And he went to school in London eventually. He was discovered, as Henry Kissinger was during the war, as being someone who was pliable to the ideas of the New World Order or world government or the Illuminati, and all of which is the same thing. And so George was brought along just like Kissinger was, both very bright young Jewish people. And in that process throughout the years, they lost their Jewishness and became members of this secret cult, is what it is. It's been in existence for many, many, many years. And so George then became involved in business. And what they do in the Illuminati is that they know certain things are going to happen or they're going to make them happen. And their emissaries, such as George and Kissinger and Brzezinski and key people like that, are allowed to go in and make fabulous amounts of money, and then they're directed as to how they spend it. And then when they are deceased, the money funnels back to the Illuminist compound, so to speak. And so this is where George got his money, by inside information. And it was about 2 years ago, on an original market rigging case in France, that George was convicted. And then it was two years ago, he appealed and lost the appeal. They didn't put him in jail, which they should have, but the Illuminists don't go to jail because there's too many people within all the governments that are members of the Illuminati. And so they never go to jail. Somebody pays a fine, usually a company or a corporation. In this case, George paid the fine himself. And then again, he was caught about a year ago and convicted in Hungary of doing the same thing again. In 1990-92, there was a group of currencies in Europe that were formed together, and they were set to, as to their values against one another, and the British pound was one of them. And so George was giving the information on the pound, and he shorted it, and then the pound left this group and plunged dramatically and down to about 120 to a dollar. Currently it's about 158, and it's been as high as 2 in the last 2 years. So you can see it was quite a plunge, and George made billions and billions of dollars. He then took that and formed the Open Society, and he formed these, you might call them, psychopolitical power groups, guerrilla operations, in the former communist bloc countries, where they created revolutions such as the pink and the blue and the orange and so on. And these revolutions were all financed by him as an instrument of the Illuminati. And that was to offset any power that could continue to be exercised commercially and otherwise with the countries involved. And so it was the total political organization. And in each instance, it ruined each country. I mean, look at the Ukraine today. It's upside down. And then the experiment with spraying H1B1 virus all over the country. And then, people got sick and many people died. That didn't happen by chance either. It was to bring the Ukrainians into line. If you don't get in line, we'll kill you all. That was the message. Just like the kulaks were eliminated by Joseph Stalin 80 years ago. And so the evolution of George Soros has been one in the service of, you might say, Satan. And he works for the Illuminati. He's a front man. Whenever they have a project, he'll come out and say the stock market's going up and this is why, and then there'll be this big push behind him and the stock market will go up. At the World Economic Forum a week ago, he said gold's a bubble and it's going to go down, and of course the forces with him attacked gold and through the derivative and futures market and made it go down, and it's turning now, and I think it's going to go right back up again, because this sort of procedure without the sale of gold itself cannot be lasting, because they have to cover those positions. And so this is what George Soros does. Henry Kissinger used to do it. Brzezinski still does it. And these have been the most visual of the Illuminati stooges, is what I call them, in exercising power over the world, and power particularly over the financial world, by the Illuminists.
Well, that's right, and you bring up Henry Kissinger, which I think is an apt analogy, because, of course, he did come, as you say, up through the ranks about the same time, being recruited around the World War II era, and, of course, he was definitely a creature of Rockefeller, and that's been well documented by people like Gary Allen and many others. In fact, that's even been openly editorialized for many decades now that he has been, shall we say, suspiciously well provided for by the various Rockefellers, not just David. But certainly, I think they're two of a kind in that they are both working for powers behind the scenes, and that's easy enough to demonstrate. But I guess fleshing that out a little bit, we do find time and again throughout at least 20th century history, for example, the name is escaping me at the moment, but I know that at least one of the most famous robber barons, I believe it was J.P. Morgan, back in the early 20th century, when he died, it was discovered that most of his fortune actually belonged to the Rothschilds, that in fact he only had a very small percentage of what was attributed to him and his corporation. So am I right with that it was Morgan that I'm talking
Absolutely
about?
Absolutely right. And the Rothschilds actually front for the royal families of Europe. And that's really who the power belongs to. The Queen of England is worth hundreds of billions of dollars, if not in the trillions. And she's the leader of the pack over there. Before her, it was the Count von Turn and Taxis. And the Count died about 20 years ago of a heart attack at 62 years old, unexpectedly. And the European nobility just freaked out. They said, well, you know, who's going to take care of this thing? So they laid it on the queen and the people around her. And so they are leading the group right now. And there was a lot of consternation after the Count died. And as you can see, this crosses country lines. And all these people are interrelated who are royalty in Europe. The people in England are basically a combination because of interbreeding of German, Dutch, and even Italian. If you go back to the disbursement in 1438 after the collapse of the Lombard system, there were only two places that would take the exiles, and among them were the people who eventually became the rulers of England, who had been top Venetian families who had been ejected because they destroyed the financial system after stealing it from the Crusaders a couple of hundred years before. And the only two places it would take them were Holland and Wales, which was a remote section of England at that time. And the Venetians got together with the Lowland Scots, and they took over the House of Windsor. And that's the evolutionary process that involved the nobility. I could spend days talking about this because I know a great deal about it. But these people all operate together. And they were very upset because the Count had married a model who was not too quick in the mind. And they were all concerned about some foolish things that she might do, and as it turned out, she didn't. But the fortunes are colossal. I mean, it's beyond imagination, and it's been going on for hundreds of years. And this is what we're fighting.
I think it is, and you bring up the idea that the Rothschilds are a front for the royal families. So, and that's something that often comes up. Is it the Rothschilds that is manipulating things behind the royalty? Is it the royalty that's manipulating the Rothschilds? Are there other groups and forces behind them that we don't even know about? And this is something that often comes up. So explain the relationship that developed between the Rothschilds and the royalty, and how did the Rothschilds really get their start?
Well, they were schmatas, gildas. I can just take them from Frankfurt onward, 15th century. They evolved as money changers and people involved in business. They became very wealthy, and then they started lending to royal families, and they got deeply involved in them, and they got so powerful that they started to intermarry with them. And the name is just put out front. It's like a, you know, the red shield is Rothschild. And they were just a shield for the nobility in Europe. And, of course, when they want, you know, and England says, well, look, you know, we want to have a war with France over there because, you know, we got to keep the people, and we're having a terrible economic thing going on here, and we don't have any money, so... the Rothschilds would step in on behalf of the other royal families. They finance both sides of the war. They go out and kill a few million people, and people forget about the financial and economic situation in the country because they're more afraid of being killed. And they've used this ruse over and over again. Well, behind the scenes, the Rothschilds and people like them were financing both sides of every war, starting probably around the 13th century.
Well, that's right, and that's a key point, because we know that obviously the royalty of Europe is all interrelated, and it went in times of revolt or uprising among the populace, they would write to their cousin across in the next country and start talking about how they needed a war in order to keep the population rallied around the crown, and then they'd start a war with their cousin. And it's important to understand that, yes, that was financed by this, I guess, front family, the Rothschilds, who had their fingers in every part of the European pie, I guess. So certainly that was an important enabling part of that.
Well, they weren't the only ones, but they're the ones that lasted the longest, and they're still prominent today.
That's right. In fact, we have David Rothschild now, who is being touted as some sort of environmental Jesus for his incredible work promoting the carbon eugenics fraud. So we certainly see that they're still able to get in the spotlight when they want to.
Well, that's because they wanted to have a carbon-based currency. That's what that's all really about. And, of course, euthanasia is part of it, there's a whole list of things. One of the things I learned early on is that when these people do things, they have more than one goal. They usually have two or three or four goals that they want to reach during whatever they're doing. And so if it becomes obvious that they want control of so-called carbon emissions, then you look at what the real reasons are. And you just mentioned carbon credits and then carbon currencies and the carbon controls and you know, it's just another scam. And one scam after another, and every one of these governments are in on it because the people who control them from behind the scenes with campaign contributions are the ones.
That's right, and it's important to let the listeners know that we're not just making this up, the connections between the Rothschilds. It's actually very much there to be seen, and we see that in things like the, I believe it's the World Development Bank, which the Rothschilds were instrumental in setting up, which is one of the main agencies that will be set up for handling the carbon currency as it develops. But what can you tell us about that push for carbon currency?
Well, I personally, I look at the whole thing after being involved for 50 years, and they got to be out of their minds to think that they're going to make this thing stick. I mean, they would have to control every person on the planet, and that's not going to happen. It just isn't going to happen because communications today, programs like this, talk programs, the internet, I mean, the minute something happens, within an hour, everybody knows about it in the entire world. And you get a different view than you do or would have gotten from the mainline media, which is 98% controlled by these people. And so they get a real problem. I discuss it on Alex's show all the time. We've got them on the run. And they don't know what to do. And they created this monster. And I think it's funny that it's devouring them. Because every time they try to move one way or the other, people like me get on the radio and say, look, this is what this carbon thing is all about. I did about maybe 100 programs on that all over the country, AM, FM, satellite, shortwave, you name it, I did it. And all of a sudden, other people picked up on it, and then what happened was that everybody realized it was a scam, and they couldn't do it. They couldn't get the legislation passed. And, of course, we were helped by the exposure of the emails and what was called ClimateGate. And that destroyed that whole thing. They'll never be able to revive it, no matter what they do.
I agree completely. I think their agenda has been mortally wounded in that area because of the incredible liberating power of the internet and the way that it's completely and utterly transformed the way that information is collected and disseminated. And it's truly changed the game. And that's one of the reasons why we have to be so vigilant to guard our online liberties and freedom of speech on the internet, which of course is always under attack through things like Senator Rockefeller's bill S-773 in the U.S. Senate to give the president powers to take control of the internet during cybersecurity emergencies and to even shut down private networks and even the internet itself if there is such an emergency, which is why we have to fight back against things like that. But turning back to some of the list of characters that we can go through, the assorted backgrounds, let's turn to some of the other financial oligarchs. For example, we talked about George Soros, so another one that we can mention in that vein, I guess, would be Warren Buffett. And one thing that I always like to bring up about Warren Buffett is that where was he on 9/11? And it turns out that he was holding his last annual golf charity event at the U.S. Stratcom headquarters at the Air Force Base in Omaha, the Offutt Air Force Base, which just happened to be one of the stops that George Bush made on his way back to Washington on 9/11. And why did he stop at Offutt Air Force Base? Well, the U.S. Stratcom, of course, is there, and of course it's the only place where the president can actually physically control the nuclear arsenal of the United States. And it also happened to be where Warren Buffett was hosting this annual golf charity event with many of the leaders, the presidents and CEOs of the companies that were in the World Trade Center. They were all in Offutt Air Force Base that day and just happened to get a chance to meet the president on 9/11. So a very, very interesting incident. But what else can you tell us about Buffett and where he comes from?
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as coincidence. And they were all there for a reason. Buffett, his father was a senator, and the family became involved in the Illuminists perhaps 100 years ago. And all of the money that Warren Buffett has made has been made based on inside information. And if you look into what he's done, you'll see that most of the things that he's done have been in conjunction with some government program or another. And I think the crowning achievement, which they tried to keep out of the press, was that 2 weeks ago, Berkshire Hathaway, which is his company, was fined $100 million for fraudulent accounting, and because they stole $200 million. It's just like Michael Milken stole $3 billion, gave $2 billion back, and kept $1 billion. So it pays to be a criminal in America if you're connected with the right people. And Milken was connected with the Zionist group, so to speak. And so when these things happen, they just go away. The Illuminists never go to jail. They pay a fine. And the fine is usually paid by a company. And the company is owned by shareholders. And sometimes, in Buffett's case, by Buffett's own holdings in the company. So he partially paid the $100 million fine, but the shareholders paid most of it. And so Warren didn't have to take it out of his pocket. He puts it in a trust with Bill Gates, which they do not lose control of. It's a charitable trust. It's been around since about 1845, that kind of trust. And people are still using them today, the wealthy. And they keep complete control of the money and use that money just like Soros, and just like Kissinger and Brzezinski do, although the latter two don't have the amount of wealth that the others do, in programs specifically that the Illuminati wants forwarded. And so that's where that money goes. Now, they're supposedly saving children, when in fact they're making business for the drug companies whose major shareholders are Illuminists and their foundations. I mean, you look at this H1B1 virus, the top person in Europe in the investigative category of looking into that said the whole thing was a scam by the pharmaceutical companies, period. And so all this money was made because the pharmaceutical companies weren't doing too well. And so they dropped this thing up, and they killed a scores of people, and they made everybody think that they had to have these shots. Well, so many of the people got wind of what was going on because of the internet and talk radio programs, that about perhaps one-third of the people who were supposed to take the shots took them. And so they didn't use as many shots as they were supposed to, but governments paid for them. Now what are they going to do with them? Dump them? And so, you know, this is a giant scam. And they do these kinds of things all the time.
Well, you're absolutely spot on with your analysis there, because a key part of the financial structure that they've created are these charitable foundations, which are meant to be doing wonderful services around the world. But as we no, of course, these are used as merely fronts for forwarding and extending the power of the Illuminists around the world in their various agenda issues. So we saw that develop, really, I believe, in the early part of the 20th century when the robber barons managed to establish these tax-free, tax-exempt foundations, which they could put their immense, incalculable wealth into, of course, on the condition that it be used for charitable purposes. And then we see how, for example, the Rockefellers used their influence and their power to truly transform the world in a number of ways, everything from genetic modification to new biotechnologies to developing immunizations and funding that agenda, all sorts of things which are just unspeakable, really, and have really extended so much horrible suffering around the world. And you mentioned people like Buffett and Bill Gates teaming up. And an interesting story that came out last year was a secret meeting that took place in New York at Rockefeller University between Soros and Buffett and Rockefeller and Kissinger and Ted Turner and
Oprah
Bill Gates
Winfrey.
And Oprah Winfrey. Yes, exactly. And of course, were they discussing?
You see, they set her up and she made a fortune. And so now she does what they tell her to do.
Exactly. And what were they discussing at that meeting?
Don't know. I can't remember.
They were discussing population reduction, of course, because that's exactly what they're so afraid of, is the population growing. But when they give vaccines to third world countries, it's because they love them and want each and every child to grow up sound and strong, right? Yes, well, of course not. Well, very interesting. So of course, Oprah Winfrey we see being set up to be a media mogul. We see Ted Turner, of course, there, Bill Gates. Anything interesting you have on the backgrounds of some of those people?
No, I think with the case of Turner, they did the same thing as they did with Soros. I think the technology that Gates had was given to the family, and that's how they roped him in. And, he's a vassal of the state, so to speak. And, I spent 28 years on Wall Street, and it's a hard slog to be successful. And, you're not able to accumulate massive wealth unless you're a criminal. I mean, you've just seen this recently in the hearings in the House. You get people like Blank Fine or whatever his name is, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, telling people that he's doing God's work, and then saying, "Well, we made a mistake, and we're supposed to brush it off," when trillions of dollars were stolen, and they get away with it. And so, the only way you can accumulate mega amounts of money and power is by doing it illegally. And that's what they do. I was not very popular when I was in the brokerage business, I'll tell you that.
I can imagine.
In fact, I've never been popular at any time with the government or anybody on Wall Street or finance, because I've been always able to see through what they're doing. And they don't like that one bit.
They don't like that, but I assume they like it even less when you go and talk about what they're doing, so... This is a valuable part of the
process. I don't live in the United States.
Exactly. Okay, well, how about some of the current stooges in the White House and in the Fed these days? So, for example, we have the chairman of the Fed, who just got reappointed, Ben Bernanke, who has an interesting nickname, Helicopter Ben. How did he get that nickname, Mr. Chapman?
Well, he said if we have a problem and we need capital infusion, we have a thing called the printing press, and we just print up the money and load it on helicopters and drop it over the country.
That's right. What a wonderful idea.
A statement coming from an academic who essentially is an intellect, and it was dumb. But anyway, that's how he got the label, and he was plucked because his ideas are closely associated with those who are in control, and his specialty was in handling an economy like the economy that existed during the 1930s, which was something that was his specialty as a professor. And so that's why he was chosen. He only does what he's told to do. And the same with Greenspan. They sell out. And for a large amount, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, these people accumulate eventually if they live long enough. And their families are taken care of. And this thing is a conspiracy. There's absolutely no question. I mean, that's how this thing works. I mean, look at Timothy Geithner. He went from the government to Goldman Sachs to the government, and then further on in the government. He was the one who, along with Robert Rubin, set up the, in 1995, the Strong Dollar Program, which entailed the suppression of the gold price. And then, of course, in 1988, when the executive order was signed by Ronald Reagan, forming the President's Group and President's Working Group on Financial Markets, they would be able to do anything they wanted. And of course, Reagan didn't understand that because he knew nothing about the market. And I can assure you of that because I knew Ronald Reagan very well. I was on his Speaker's Bureau in 1965 when he was running for governor the first time, and I used to travel all over the place with him. And his brother and I both filled him in on what was really going on. And in fact, Lynn Nofsig, who was the head of the campaign at that time, kicked me off the bureau because I was telling Reagan all about this stuff. He couldn't kick his brother out because his brother was his brother. And they had a lot of stuff on Ronnie that I'll never go into that I know about. And Ronnie was a good guy, but he had his shortcomings, believe me. And he wasn't the person you thought he was, just let it put it that way. And so anyway, with this working group in financial markets, they were able to start manipulating everything. And they've been doing it, and they've been doing it in a higher order, or quicker or faster or more than they've ever done it before in the last 10 years and more nearly the last couple of years.
That's right. You mentioned Timothy Geithner, and of course he was also a tax evader. You mentioned Alan Greenspan, who was a sellout, but it's, I think, very, very interesting for people when they learn what Greenspan was talking about back in the 60s.
Well, you know, we were well aware of it. Gary Allen, who was my partner, went Nundy to call it conspiracy. In fact, yesterday Alex was looking for some copies of it. I got about 20 copies. And I don't know how many are left around, but we printed millions of them, and I helped Gary finance that. And Gary and I later had the Gary Allen report because he wasn't happy with his relationship with Larry Abraham, who is now deceased. But we would talk about that along with G. Edward Griffith and Alan Stang and Anthony Hilder. We were kind of the over-the-hill gang, so to speak. And, of course, very few people were listening to us in those days. But we were telling people then the same thing that we're telling them now. 50 years later, of course, a lot has happened in between, and we got a lot more to add to it to prove that we were right. But we got the whole story, and we're passing that on to everybody on radio and on the Internet and who can read the international forecaster that we can. And it's working.
Yes,
finally.
It took us 50 years. Finally.
I only wish we had these instruments to work with in 1960 that we have today.
Well, you did the yeoman's work and laid the groundwork for what's happening today. And I think without the work that was being done by yourself and Gary Allen and G. Edward Griffin and many others, I don't think the movement that we have today would exist in its present form. And so certainly we have to be dedicated to the people who have gone before and who have done this work for so many decades. So my hat's off to you certainly for doing what you're doing. And on that note, why don't we talk a little bit about what you're doing, and why don't you tell us more about the International Forecaster?
Well, the forecast is about business, finance, economic, social, political issues all over the world. We publish by email on Wednesdays and Saturdays, runs around 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy for those who are on the Internet that goes out twice a month, and you can get a free introductory copy simply by going to our site, and it's a current copy, incidentally. And that address is theinternationalforecaster.com. TheInternationalForecaster.com. If you have a question, we answer everybody. You email us, bob@intforecaster.com. That's bob@intforecaster.com. Or you can call toll-free 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. And you can get a free introductory copy. And all the news that you need to know every week is in the International Forecaster. I can assure you of that.
Bob Chapman, incredible talking to you as always. Thank you once again, and I look forward to talking with you again next month.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for listening. Bye-bye.